Cool. If you would like to turn to Matthew 24, verses 1 to 16. Jesus left the temple and was walking away with his disciples. When his disciples came up to him to call his attention to its buildings, "Do you see all these things?" he asked. "Truly I tell you, not one stone here will be left on another. Everyone will be thrown down." As Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately. "Tell us," they said, "when will this happen, and what will be the sign of your coming and the end of all age?" Jesus answered, "Watch out that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name claiming, 'I am the Messiah,' and will deceive many. Hear of wars and rumors of wars, but see to it that you are not alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come. Nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of birth pains. Then you will be handed over to be persecuted and put to death, and you will be hated by all nations because of me. At that time, many will turn from their faith and will betray and hate each other, and many false prophets will appear and deceive many people. Because of the increase of wickedness, the love of most will grow cold. But the one who stands firm to the end will be saved. And this is the gospel of the kingdom, will be preached in the whole earth as testimony to all nations, and the end will come. So when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation, spoken through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains."
It's interesting, when it comes to stories and narratives, humanity in general tends to be more skeptical. It's difficult for us sometimes to hear something or see something and not read more into it. A great example of that are conspiracy theories. We can't just stop and believe that it's just really what's happened. There's got to be more. Great case is the story of JFK. Right? It can't be just one shooter. He was set up. There was someone else. "I heard a gunshot over there, but what's going on over here? Something else is happening." The narrative must be hidden. And so we dig for more. It can't be possible, but that is it. When it comes to end times and the Bible and apocalyptic literature, we want to read more, more and more. More and more. It's really interesting. If I do a sermon on end times, I can get more people to church than if I just did a sermon on Jesus' death and resurrection. Ain't that true? But it's truth, because we want to know what's going on. So this morning, we're going to go into these verses, Matthew chapter 24 and 25. There's a lot of information. There's a lot that I'm going to get us through, and we don't have much time. So I want to give you an opportunity right now to stretch. If you feel comfortable turning to the person next to them and just giving them a little massage on the temple, because they're going to need it today. Maybe on the shoulders, up around the neck. If you've got one person in front of you, you feel comfortable doing. If you don't feel comfortable, don't do it. If you're just on your own, give yourself a big stretch, because we are going to stretch you this morning. And you know me well enough to know when I'm telling you this morning's going to be a challenge, it really is going to be a challenge. So fasten your seatbelts, right? Okay. We're going to open up the beginning of chapter 23, verses 1 to 3. Jesus left the temple and was walking away when his disciples came up to him to call his attention to its buildings. "Do you see all these things?" he asked. "Truly I tell you, not one stone here will be left on another. Every one will be thrown down." And so as Jesus had gone away and they sat down there at the Mount of Olives across from Jerusalem, the disciples came up to him privately. "Tell us," they said, "when will this happen? What will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age?" And thus begins this great discourse that Jesus gets into. And these two chapters are extraordinary for the amount of information I can find on this. There is a whole lot more on this than on his death and resurrection. There's a whole lot more in these two chapters than on anything. And people have argued for the ages over what is written here. But there is something actually very simple about this. There's something that we take completely out of context. And that is what sparked this discussion to begin with. It's simple. The disciples have a couple of questions. When will this all happen? When will the temple disappear? That's cataclysmic. That's huge. When's that going to happen? And hey, by the way, when are you actually going to make yourself known as Messiah? We're in Jerusalem now. When's this going to happen? And when will this age end? By the way, it says age, not the end of the world. We tend to read into things a little too much, like the shooter on the grassy knoll. When will this age end? They're all centered around this discussion. And there are three questions that come out of it. We're going to spend most of our time on the first question because the first question is key to answering the next two questions. And that is this, the destruction of the temple, when will it be destroyed? You need to understand how important this temple is. It is God's house on earth. But far deeper than just his presence on earth, it is the sign of the covenant between God's chosen people and God himself. It's where the nation can come and find reconciliation and repentance before God. That's where the sacrifices happened. The atonement occurred. And inside the temple, the menorah, and the showbread, the table, signs of this covenant, and then the most holy place, the Ark of the Covenant itself, along with the presence of God. Now, if that's destroyed, what's going to happen? How a new age is going to come in. No more do we have the temple age. We'll have all this other stuff going on. So Jesus, when is this going to happen? And he answers it. He says, when you see standing in the holy place, the place that only the high priest can go into, the place that only one man once a year can enter into, when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation spoken of through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee. Run away. Now this abomination that causes desolation. Oh my goodness. Just type that in to Google. And go under images. Oh my goodness. No idea what people are getting themselves into with this stuff. I've heard preachers preach on this and I've just said, no, what are you saying? The abomination that causes desolation. Jesus is talking about something or someone stepping into the holy place and desecrating a space that is reserved for God. And we see it. It first comes up in the book of Daniel. This idea of who this abomination, or what this abomination that causes desolation, what it will do, who it is, how is it going to work. And in fact, all through chapter 24 and 25, Jesus is dependent wholly on the prophecies of Daniel. He's almost repeating them verbatim. We'll get into that a little later on. In the Gospels, it only appears twice. Again, Mark and Matthew recounting the same story. And then there's this really curious interaction in Revelation chapter 13 that unpacks who this abomination is. That's a whole sermon in and of itself. If you want to go back, we've preached on it. I might have to revisit it again sometime soon. But this abomination that causes desolation, to understand this, I actually need to give you a history lesson. Okay, because it's really interesting how we can just take a word or something completely out of context and make up our own meaning and definition for it. When we say kingdoms rise and kingdoms fall, do they literally like lift up off the earth or fall down to the earth or fall under the earth? Do we really mean that? Do we? No. But imagine 1,000 years from now, group of really, really, really intelligent human beings are sitting around looking at some old paperwork from 1,000 years ago. This kingdom of the United States rose and then fell. Oh my goodness, I would have loved to have seen that. Like it did lift up? Yeah, back in those days, a lot of things happened like that. And we'd be sitting here going, what? There'll be some idiot in the corner there going, they're just describing something. Oh, you be quiet. It's almost the same for us when it comes to end times. The ones who are actually speaking truth are getting shoved in the corner because it's not revolutionary enough. It's not grandiose enough. So let me give you a history lesson. It's going to help you because it will answer that first question and it'll be as clear as day. So first of all, what we need to look at is how did this temple come into play? Okay? From the time of Exodus, when they left Egypt, they went to Mount Sinai, they got the law and everything. God told them to set up the tabernacle or the tent of meeting, kind of a portable... can someone please get me a glass of water, by the way, because I'm starting already to lose my voice and I've got a long way to go. So Exodus, to about 1000 BC was this portable temple, which is kind of cool. Every time they moved around, they set up the temple, they set up the tent of meeting, the sacrifices were made out the front, inside you had the holy place, and then the most holy place where the Ark of the Covenant stood. And this went on till about 1000 BC when a guy named Solomon, king, son of David, built the first immovable temple. It was situated right there, built, great story around it, how he designed it and built it according to God's specifications, and it lasted for a little over 400 years until the Babylonians came and attacked, destroyed Jerusalem, destroyed the temple, and carted off a big group of Jews off back into Babylon into captivity, and there was no temple no more. But when the Persian Empire came through and overthrew the Babylonian Empire, Darius allowed some of the Jews to go back to Judea and they rebuilt the temple. And it's what we call the Second Temple period from about 517 BC to 70 AD. This is the temple that Jesus knew. This is the temple that we hear about in the Gospels. Thank you, John. Sorry. And... So that's the temple that we all know about. That was built in about 517 BC and lasted till about 70 AD. And it's this period that I want to dive into a little bit more because leading up to this is really interesting. About 539 to 332 BC, the Persians ruled Judea and the Jews lived in relative peace. They were allowed to do what they wanted. They had their temple, they did their thing. And it's actually quite a nice period for them. But then come 332 BC, the Greeks conquered the Persian Empire. Alexander the Great spread out the empire right through the Middle East, almost as far as India, through North Africa. And when he died, his empire was broken into four different different sections. The section that Judea found themselves under was ruled by one of his old generals called Seleucid. It became known as the Seleucid Empire. And at about 167 BC, a guy who was a descendant of Seleucid, he called Antiochus IV, decided that Judea needed a lesson in becoming Greek. So he showed up to the temple, he walked into the holy place and set up a statue of Zeus. And immediately, all the images from Daniel's prophecy hit all the rabbis. This is the abomination that causes desolation. He set up this graven image in our temple. This is bad. But the problem is this abomination didn't really cause desolation. What it did cause was a revolt, what we call the Maccabean Revolt. Judas's father began it, and then Judas Maccabee himself fought for about 20 plus years, guerrilla warfare against the Greeks. And guess what? No, they won. They actually won. They won. They won. They gained independence for the first time in over 400 years. Judea was its own country, autonomous, independent, and they were loving it. So that abomination really didn't really cause much desolation. All it did was gear the people together. But the problem was with the Jews was that they started fighting amongst themselves. Guess what over? Come on, think of a church. What do we always fight over? Money. The color of the paint coming up the stairs. Yeah, I know. No, theology. They fought over theology. This is a time when the Sadducees and the Pharisees became prominent. One was for, one was against. They fought against each other. And a guy named Antipas, who was an advisor for one of these groups, saw that things weren't going very well, and he did the worst possible thing. He called up, literally got on the phone and talked to the next big country that was starting to come up, this empire called Rome, and he said, "You guys need to come down here and sort things out." And that was literally the beginning of the end. 63 BC, the Romans sent what is most probably the greatest general of all time, a guy named Pompey, who, thanks to him, single-handedly basically gave Rome an empire. And he came down, destroyed everything in his path, came into the temple, set himself up in the most holy place, and threw the Roman standards up on the wall inside the temple. And this was the beginning of the abomination that would cause, ultimately, desolation. This was 63 BC. From this point on, Judea had lost its independence. It became a puppet state of Rome. And ultimately, when things started to get a little out of hand again, the Roman Senate then voted who the next king of the Jews should be. And it happened to be Antipas' son, a guy named Herod the Great. And once he was appointed as king, that was it. They were completely and absolutely subjugated to Rome. During this period in time, we can read a lot about it in the New Testament. This is the time when Jesus then comes to the fore. This is the time when the apostles start going out. But the Jews are looking for a savior. They're looking for a Messiah. When we've heard the sermons of the last few weeks, when we hear this anticipation and this expectation of who this Messiah is, they're looking for a political leader. They're looking for someone who's going to come and fight, who's going to overthrow this so that he can bring the people back together again and that he can unite the nation again and they can truly be the people of God. That's what they wanted from Jesus. That's what the apostles were waiting for. That's what they were hoping for. Instead, it doesn't happen. And it gets to a point where things start to get out of hand. And the first Jewish-Roman war began in 66 AD. And of course, the Romans, always so light-handed with things, never, send down their greatest general of the time, a guy named Flavius Vespasian. And he came down and began this war. And by the time it got to about 68 AD, Nero was king. Nero committed suicide, and Rome fell into civil war. In the space of 1 year, they had four emperors. The first one was murdered. The second one was deposed. The third one took control by force, a guy named Vitellius. And then the Senate called for Vespasian to come back and bring order. And he came back, defeated Vitellius, and he was named the new emperor, the Emperor Vespasian. He left behind his son Titus, who went on to finish the work that his father had started. He arrived into Jerusalem, he destroyed it completely, and the temple itself was absolutely and completely razed to the ground. And on the spot of where the Holy of Holies was, Titus stuck the Roman standards right there and then. But this is not yet the desolation that Jesus was talking about. Of course, it might feel like desolation when the one icon that gave you hope, the one thing as a nation that stood for who you were and the covenant you had with God is gone. I can only imagine what that would have meant socially for the Jews. All the inhabitants of Jerusalem were carted off as slaves back to Rome. Vespasian wanting to give his son, a huge honor. They had a parade down the Appian Way, and he had an arc of triumph built in his son's honor. It's called the Ark of Titus. If you go to Rome, as you enter into the forum, it stands right there. And there on the side of it, you can see, you know, the symbols of the Jewish temple that no one would have ever seen, because for 500 years it stayed behind closed doors. Only the priests could see it. And now everyone in Rome is seeing the menorah and the shofars out for the world to see. And behind them, all the Jewish slaves. They melted all the gold down, and the slaves were brought together, and they built an icon that is now standing in Rome. That Colosseum is built on the slaves from Jerusalem with the gold from the temple. So next time you visit Rome and you stand before a monument that thousands every week go and visit, just think of how it got there. And yet that's still not desolation. You see, the destroying of a temple and of Jerusalem, the Jews still could live in Jerusalem. They could still live in their place with the hope that they could rebuild maybe one day this temple. Then a new emperor was made. His name was Hadrian. The emperor Hadrian came about, a true son of Rome, spent most of his time traveling around the empire, making sure everybody understood what Rome was about. And when he came to the ruins of the temple in Jerusalem, he wanted to build a statue of Jupiter right on the spot of the Holy of Holies. And from the north in Galilee, a man stood up. His name was Simon Bar Kokhba. And he was declared by the priests as the Messiah. And people rallied behind him. And thus began in 32 AD the Bar Kokhba revolt. They believed he was the Messiah. He was approved by the Pharisees and the Sadducees. He was approved by the elite in the Jewish society. And they fought. Everyone went behind him and fought. And for 3 long years, actually, they really did take it to the Romans. In the end, Hadrian had to send over a third of the Roman infantry to Judea to deal with it. And even though the Jews were outnumbered almost 10 to 1 at points in the battle, they really gave it to him, but they were no match. Hadrian was so angry about what he had to deal with that he razed Jerusalem to the ground. He expelled the Jews from Jerusalem and Judea, and he wiped the name of Judea from the maps. All of the Roman maps were forced to eliminate the word Judea, and it was replaced with this word. And here is where the desolation happens. And all of a sudden, the words of Jesus start to hit home. Because if you're a Jew at that time, some of them may still have been alive who had known Jesus. They'd be very old. But certainly the next generation whose words of Jesus are still there, clear in their minds. When he told them, hey, when the abomination that causes desolation stands there in the holy place, run. There'll be a whole lot of them saying, hey, we're the Messiah. Don't follow them. Run. They chose to follow him. J.E. Taylor, a wonderful book he wrote, he says this, he says, unlike the aftermath of the first Jewish-Roman war chronicled by Josephus, the Jewish population of Judea was devastated after the Bar Kokhba revolt, being killed, exiled, or sold into slavery, and Jewish religious and political authority was suppressed far more brutally than before. The Jews suffered a serious blow in Jerusalem and its environs in Judah, a blow that has taken almost 2 millennia to recover from. Does that put into context the abomination that causes desolation? If you were a Jew and you knew that was your future, where everything you have grown up to believe, that your people will be dispersed amongst the world, as Titus, who only got to live a couple of years before his younger brother Domitian decided to give him a bit of poison. Titus made the comment when he was asked, "Don't you feel bad destroying, you know, this symbol, this temple?" And he says, "No, I am but the wrath of God." I don't know if you knew how close his words were to it. When will it be destroyed? When is this? What we don't understand is from that moment, for the Jew, the age has changed. The age of the temple is gone. There is a new age that doesn't require a temple anymore. And I'm really confused when I see Christians supporting the rebuilding of a temple in Jerusalem. I'm really confused by it. I'll say something really controversial right now. But I would rather there be a mosque in that space than another temple. Why? Why? I'll tell you why. A temple will negate everything Jesus has done. A temple will literally negate everything he's done. The sacrifice has been made once and for all. The access to God is through Jesus Christ, not through the Holy of Holies. Right? So why would we support another temple? That ground, in my mind, is cursed. Let it be. People have been fighting over that piece of land for I don't know how long. And Jesus said, "Hey, look, a new age is coming. You're thinking it's the end of the world. Let me give you a whole other thing. It's the beginning of the world." It might feel like that this is going to feel like the end of the world because everything you know is gone. But let me give you something far more powerful than any building can hold. Let me give you something far more powerful than any Ark of the Covenant could hold. My blood. The blood of Jesus Christ. It's a new age. And our brothers and sisters who are Jews who have for years and years and generations felt lost. Messiah has come. Messiah has come. The next question, which, you know, I kind of went through this and I thought, I think I've answered this. I don't know. The Greek word here is coming, is parousia. Jesus is parousia. Theologians love to use these words that sound really cool when they're in Greek, right? But the reality is parousia has so much more meaning than just coming. It's unveiling. It's kind of like the unveiling of Jesus, in a sense. We normally translate it as coming, but the Greeks used it when the emperor would come and visit the towns. They would say it would be, you know, whoever the emperor is, it's his parousia. Or if a Greek god did something incredible that revealed himself, that was that god's parousia. Here they're asking about Jesus's, you know, when are you going to be unveiled, Jesus? When are you coming? When will you be seen as the Messiah? Some of us just read that and we're thinking the second coming. Let me tell you, the disciples had, they just wanted the first one. That's what they were interested in. They weren't interested, they didn't even think of what the second coming would be. We're all sitting here going, oh, he's talking about his second coming. And if we had Peter right here with us, he'd be like, guys, we just wanted the first. When was that going to happen? Right? They're trying to figure out what's going on here. And we've read it all the way through Matthew. If you haven't, go back and listen to the sermons and look at those verses. They seem to be questioning him all the way. What are you doing? How's it going to be? When's it? When are you finally going to tell everybody you're the Messiah? When is it going to happen that Rome's going to go and we're going to have our state again? And this is what they're asking. When will you be revealed? Immediately after the distress of those days, when the abomination starts to take hold, Jesus says this. He uses Isaiah. He says, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from the sky and the heavenly bodies will be shaken. And I've heard this from pastors preaching about the end times, using this verse and losing completely what it would have meant to first century Jews. They weren't literal about it. They looked at that and they heard that and they understood immediately, oh, big social upheaval. Oh, something big's going to happen. They didn't believe the skies would be darkened, that the moon would fall from the sky. And some of us here are waiting for that to happen. But what he's talking about here is the big social upheaval. That's what the Jews understood. Rabbinic teachings unpack this time and time again. The flowery language of the prophets. It was a cue word to say, kingdoms will rise and kingdoms will fall. He goes on, then there will appear the sign of man in heaven, and there will be all peoples of the earth will mourn when they see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory, and he will send his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from all the four winds, from one of end of the heavens to the other. He is quoting directly from Daniel. Again, all this chapter, if you want to understand it better, you've got to read the prophecies in Daniel. Daniel says a few things, but before we get there, he makes this last comment right after this in verse 34. He says, truly I tell you, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened. Just a little side note there. I got into a discussion this week with a friend of mine, and he was telling me that Isaiah passage has to be literal. You know, we're waiting for that to happen. And I asked him, I said, so how do you translate verse 34? He goes, oh, well, generation isn't like physically a generation. It's, you know, kind of extended over millennia. Oh, okay. So how are you interpreting this? Through what means? Are you interpreting it to make it sound good for what you think needs to happen? Going on, Daniel chapter 7 says this, in my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven, and he approached the Ancient of Days, was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All the nations and peoples of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. See, in that yellow then will appear the sign of man in heaven, and then all the peoples of the earth will mourn when they see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven. People are interpreting that as a future, something that's going to happen in the future of Jesus coming back to earth, when Daniel actually talks about Jesus going to heaven. And when he takes his rightful place at the right hand of God, usurping who? Satan. Go into Zechariah, find out where Satan sits at God's throne. Jesus takes that place as ruler. Talk about his ascension, about his victory over death, his resurrection. And he will send his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of the heavens to the other. The day of Pentecost, when his people all come together and then spread out and share the good news of who Jesus truly is. When will Jesus be seen as the Messiah? And the answer to that, the day his resurrection happens. The day he encounters Mary Magdalene in the garden where she's crying. Today is a good day. I'm not dead, I'm alive. His final words to his followers, and then he ascends to heaven to take his rightful place. When will this age end and the new one begin? Well, the new one has begun. You see, here's the thing. The disciples wanted to see Jesus ruling as king and ushering in a new age. That was what people wanted to see in the Messiah. They just didn't understand what that would look like. The fact of the matter is, he is now king. He's not the future king. He's not going to be king when he comes back. He already is king. We're not going to wait till the second coming. And let me not minimize that. There is a second coming. The great thing about what Matthew writes here, he's writing with that little bit of awareness of Jesus' second return. But let's not negate the fact that Jesus is king here and now today. Hallelujah. Amen. 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 And he's already ushered in a new age. And this is the challenge for you this morning. We are called by Jesus. We are called to live with the birth pains of God's new age, where there will be wars and rumors of wars, where there will be earthquakes and rumors of earthquakes. But we are called by Jesus to live with the birth pains of this new age. We're also called to be faithful and to hold on and not be alarmed. As he warns his disciples, there's going to be a lot going on and you're going to freak out at times. Don't worry. Hold on. Be faithful. And he's not just talking to the disciples at that point. He's now talking to all of us. Because whether we look at history now and how bad we think it is, or we look to the past, whether it was World War I or World War II or Genghis Khan or the Black Death or anything you want to throw out there, there's been a lot of bad things that happened in history. There'll be a lot more bad things happening in our future. He's asking us to be faithful and to hold on and to live through troubled times and to last out to the end. Because then he leaves us with chapter 25 and this comment, the day and the hour is unknown. I'm going to end us on this one. And I'd love to spend a whole sermon just on this phrase, the day and hour unknown. But when he's writing to his disciples, he's not talking just about his coming. He's talking about their own lives. You don't know when you are going to die. You don't know when the end will come for you. And when, you know what? When we all die, guess who we will encounter? Jesus, right? So whether we're going to encounter him here on earth or through death, we will be encountering him. The day and the hour is unknown. And he warns him. He says, some of you are going to be dying. Some of you are going to be put to death because of this. The day and the hour is unknown. Your day and hour is unknown. My day, Jesus' return, is unknown as well. And the challenge for us is, are you ready for this? Are you ready for this? He goes on with a whole bunch of parables right at the end of chapter 25. And, you know, just kind of warning us. Are you really ready for this? Because you could die tomorrow. Massive heart attack. Accident.